The Miami Montage Podcast is sponsored by P. Sullivan, the Anson Family Foundation, and the Miami Foundation. Further support comes from the Dow Jones News Fund, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the University of Miami School of Communication. From the University of Miami, this is the Miami Montage Podcast, a production of the P. Sullivan James Anson Journalism Workshop. Welcome to the Miami Montage Podcast. Today, we'll look at the story beyond the page, the hidden stories that propel the final printed piece. We'll look at the process of reporting for five young montage journalists and hear the hard choices they made as they crafted their first major workshop pieces. One comes from a student whose story on mothers with chronically ill children made her reconsider the value one life has to another. Another student looked at the anti-vax phenomenon and found that some anti-vaxxers feel unfairly stereotyped for their beliefs and have real medical reasons for their choices. Lastly, two workshop students examine how Florida is coping with school shootings 1 year after the Parkland massacre. One found communities question the need for in-school shooter drills, the first remedy to be tried. The other student, whose school holds regular drills, gained a greater awareness of the drill's weight to parents, teachers, and his peers. Those come later in the podcast. But first, Carson Merlot is a senior at St. Thomas Aquinas High School in Fort Lauderdale. A story on the dietary supplement Flat Tummy Tea revealed that many users are unaware of the safety risks they assume when they choose to follow the program.
We're in the 21st century, where we use Instagram, Snapchat, and Twitter to follow the daily trends. Sometimes these trends, such as detox teas, actually do more harm than good. I began writing my article on keto and paleo diets because many of my friends were doing them, and I wanted to see if they are as healthy as they are being portrayed. As I was doing my research, I came across the detox teas that have been circulating all throughout social media. Major companies such as Flat Tummy Tea, Fit Tea, and Boo Tea are claiming to cleanse and de-bloat if you buy their products such as detox teas, shakes, or lollipops. The most shocking part is that the FDA is not authorized to review dietary supplement products for safety and effectiveness before they are marketed. The manufacturers and distributors of dietary supplements are responsible for making sure their products are safe before they go on the market. Another challenging part of my story was finding someone who had a bad effect from taking these detox teas. Social media influencer Iman Harari Kia recounts how detox teas fueled her eating disorder. After being hooked on detox teas, she began to encounter extreme reactions when she attempted to eat a meal. It would start as a cough or a burp, but ended with projectile vomiting. A Flat Tummy Co. representative who I spoke to on an online chat said that they market towards 18 years or older. I tried localizing my story and contacted Miami-based influencer Miriam Gonzalez, who promotes these Flat Tummy Teas. And she believes that there is nothing wrong with promoting Flat Tummy Tea, and if the influencer has a journey with proven results, they are only sharing their stories. What I wanted people to learn from my article is that we should all be skeptical of nutritional advice. We should get our advice from professionals. Nadine McCauty, a lecturer at the University of Miami's Department of Kinesiology and Sports Sciences, states that diets that promise quick weight loss should not be trusted.
Benjamin Schiller is a senior at St. Andrew's School in Boca Raton, Florida. His piece on the anti-vaxxer controversy found that many national publications have not chosen to provide the most even-handed coverage of this emotionally charged issue. He strove to provide that balance.
My assignment was to find a middle ground on the controversial vaccination debate. Parents in 2019 are debating on whether to vaccinate their children, and they're looking to popular media outlets and influential sources to kind of dictate which direction they decide to go in or whether to vaccinate their kid or not. So I spoke to 5 different parents. 2 of the parents are anti-vaccination, 2 of the other parents are pro-vaccination, and 1 parent decided to delay their kids on their vaccination schedule. However, she is still anti-vaccination. So I'm going to begin with the anti-vaccination parents first. First one I would like to talk about is Lindsay. Lindsay is a mother of 5. She's from Austin, Texas, and she's a traveling family. They've been to 25 states in 3 years. Her middle child, her name is Jude. When Jude was 2 years old, he got some vaccinations. She did not remember exactly which vaccination caused him issues, but he had severe issues. He had black tar in his bowel, motor tics, sensory issues, really sensitive to light and movement. He couldn't be in the car or anything. Really bad rashes on his back. His parents, when they would hug him, he would cry, want them to go away. And he would cry for 12 hours at a time. There was really no break for him. And his mother always tried to comfort him, but he didn't want to be comforted because he was in so much pain all the time. Another parent I spoke to was Jessica. Jessica's a mother of 2 from Broward County, Florida. Her 9-year-old son got a vaccination when he was 4 years old, and it led him to have motor tics like Jude. He had his fingers would fidget, his eyes would blink, sort of like Tourette's in a way. And unfortunately, the child had depression at the age of 7. He wanted to end his life. Like Jude, Jessica's 9-year-old son had to have a process called detoxification done on his brain, in which harmful stimulants and toxins would be removed from the brain. But in order for that to happen, the blood-brain barrier would have to not be able to seal, and usually happens by age 4. So when a child gets their vaccinations before they enter preschool, if an injury were to happen, you can immediately try to reverse those causes by having detoxification done to the brain. Fortunately for both parents, they're able to get their kids to get roughly 95% of the harmful stimulants removed from the brain. And 2 other mothers that are pro-vaccination, one is Carrie. Carrie's from Broward County, Florida as well. She vaccinates both her kids, 4 years old and 3-month-year-old. She does have a medical background, so she knows exactly what's going on in these vaccinations and how the process is done and how to administer them properly. So both her kids are vaccinated. Her kids have not had any issues with them. And another parent that vaccinates her kids is Jeanette. Jeanette's a mother of 4, 3 biological children, and 1 stepdaughter. And those kids go to a Department of Defense school in Fort Knox, Kentucky. And since they're on a military base, they basically require all kids to get vaccinated, and it's very difficult to be exempt, but it's still possible. And 3 of the 4 kids never had any issues with vaccination. But her second child, Nora, who's 10 years old, had mumps, measles, chickenpox, basically every single vaccination she got, the exact same illness that would be in the vaccination. Going into the process, I've been reading a lot of articles, and I've come to the conclusion that a lot of these outlets are picking one side of the story. The New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, they're either featuring a politician that's against anti-vaxxers, or they're picking a millionaire couple who donated $1.6 million to the anti-vax movement. What's different about my piece is that I covered both sides of the debate. I spoke to parents who are pro-vaccination. I heard what they have to say. I've also listened to parents from the anti-vax movement. I've come to the conclusion that if you're a pro-vaccination, then you'd never had any issues with vaccinations. But if you're anti-vaccination, you've had issues in the past firsthand.
Chika Ojukwu is a senior at Barbara Goldman Senior High in Miami Lakes, Florida. Her profiles of 2 mothers with chronically ill children highlighted the hard choices they must make to balance their personal and professional lives and made her reassess her life choices.
There is only so much a parent can do for their child. They could provide a roof over their heads, feed them, and give them as much love as they can. But even with these actions, a chronic illness is something a parent truly cannot control. Denny Quinn and Judy Feldman share this burden. They have to cope with their children being sick and also sacrifice themselves to care for them. They are the doctors, they are the nurses, they are the therapists, and they are the friends of their children. Before coming into this article, I didn't know what kind of chronic illnesses that I would have to see in these children. The first was Denny's. Her child had FASD, which is fetal alcohol syndrome. Denny was able to educate me on the subject and show me that it occurs in more people than I initially thought. Judy, her child had Ewing's sarcoma. It is a cancer that goes against the tissue and also the bone. Its prime population is young boys of 15 years. I also learned that these mothers are advocates for their children. They often teach others what their children are facing. Both mothers go to their children's schools to teach seminars on how exactly to deal with this disease, what it means, and how it impacts more than just the child themselves. Through this experience, I was able to get into these mothers' homes. I was able to see their children's bedrooms. I was able to see pictures and albums, and it became more than, okay, this is a son with Ewing sarcoma, or this is a son with FASD. I was able to see Andrew. I was able to see Danny, because they were just two boys who had a chronic illness. And I learned so much about their own personalities, what they liked. I learned that Danny was a gymnast. I learned that Andrew loved video games. I learned all these types of things because they were able to bear to me their true selves and also their child's true selves. So this story isn't about chronic illness. It's about people. People who have been given a bad lot in life, but they're still pushing harder and harder to get better, to have hope. Seeing all this, I thought to myself, these mothers have sacrificed so much. They have done so much for their children. They have been so selfless. And it made me think, what have I done? What have I done to help another person? Have I sacrificed myself as much as they have? Seeing this, I learned that I have to share. I have to give my talents to others. Before I left Denny's home, she took me to the side and told me, please don't end this here. Please let more people know about my son's illness. He has struggled with this for his whole life, and I have struggled there with him. And so many people don't know the adverse effects of FASD. Please, do another article informing about this. Please, tell those people you know about it. These mothers made this sacrifice, and I have to respect that. I completely respect that. And this will not be the end of their story.
Marcus Caligari is a senior at Christopher Columbus High in Miami, Florida. His examination of active shooter drills, which are now practiced across the state, found that they often fail to put student, teacher, and parent minds at ease. Thomas Morcillo, a senior at Coral Gables High, made a photo essay of individuals adversely affected by shooter drills. His project, like Caligari's, found unintended and troublesome effects from these well-intentioned drills.
Everybody's scared. No matter what position they're in, no matter how prepared they think they are, they're scared. That's what I've learned from my research on school shooting drills. From students to teachers to professionals, everyone feels some sort of fear during the process of preparing for a school shooting drill, and no one is sure of an exact solution to this problem. Grace is a senior at G. Holmes Braddock High School. She's just finished third period, and she's in the hallway on her way to her fourth period. Then a principal comes over the PA and announces the school is in a code red. This means Grace's school is on lockdown. But the students don't know if this is a drill or if it's the real thing. Grace freezes she's in no man's land. These students have been trained on what to do if an attacker arrives during class time. But what if she's in the hallway? They don't drill what to do if a shooter arrives during a break. If I got stuck outside in the hallway during a drill, I would probably have an anxiety attack, she told me. It's really unsettling to think that a situation could be real and I would be stuck outside and be open and exposed to a gun during a drill. Even with the constant pushing of school shooter drills, some students are still left scared and unprepared. Annie Puig is a mother to three small children, and she's a teacher. The lockdown drills at her school increase in frequency after Parkland. These drills at their peak occurred once a month. The increase did nothing to diminish her feelings of vulnerability. Puig told me, there's definitely a fear, especially with little children, that they're going to talk or do something, especially if the situation were real and did have an incident. Puig feels the drills have added a layer of insecurity and finds herself freestyling an escape plan. You always have to have a backup plan, she told me. So if I'm here, what would I do and where would we go? The increase in drills are raising the levels of anxiety of teachers like Puig, not lessening it. Sometimes, however, these improvised preparations work. Eric Gardner is a TV production teacher at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. For the past 20 years, he's been training his students on how to act if a shooter appeared on campus. On the day of the Parkland shooting, one of Gardner's students survived by following his training. One of my training lessons, Gardner said, was what to do when you're out in the hallway. This is to ditch into a bathroom, stand on a toilet, and be silent. Be as invisible as you can be. That's what he did, and it saved his life. What the stories tell me is that more efficient ideas exist, but better communication is needed to share these ideas. Gardner's training, for example, would address Grace's fears of what to do if she was stuck in the hall. Better communication can lessen everyone's fear and increase your chance to survive a school shooting.
My assignment was to capture in photographs the emotional effects of shooter drills, not just on the students, but on teachers and parents. My approach was simple. I studied the Sun Sentinel's photo essay on Parkland survivors and used it as inspiration. As soon as I started shooting, I didn't pose the subjects. I wanted them to be as neutral as possible to capture them in their natural state. I shot in black and white because, in my experience, color can be an obstacle between the viewer and the shapes and composition of the subject. I interviewed each subject before taking their portraits to make each subject more comfortable and avoid them becoming tense. One subject that stood out was Alyssa Alfonso, a mother of three. She stood out to me because she was very passionate about children being affected by active shooter drills. She emphasized that the constant worry for an active shooter was just too much to bear for a child, and she believes that the solution to violence in schools is greater than just preparing for when a shooting happens. She teared up but powered through the interview. Another was Eric Gardner, the broadcasting teacher at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. He said that the drills, along with the building where the shooting happened, are constant reminders of that day. However, he still supports the idea of these drills, despite their triggering nature, and that the worry over violence in schools should not be the central focus of student life. I didn't think this was a problem going into the story. Shooter drills are held at my school, but they are not treated as seriously. They're seen as just another drill, like a fire drill. Shooting the series made me realize that the severity of these drills varies across schools and that they can have serious long-term effects on everyone.
The Miami Montage Podcast is sponsored by Peace Sullivan, the Anson Family Foundation, and the Miami Foundation. Further support comes from the Dow Jones News Fund, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the University of Miami School of Communication. Today's podcast was produced by Benjamin Schiller, Chika Ojuku, Thomas Morcillo, Marcus Caligari, Carson Merlot, Trevor Green, and Raphael Vela. I'm Abigail Tashman. Music for the podcast was provided by Purple Planet Music, which can be found online at www.purple-planet.com.